Lisboa, Bruxelles, Berlin, Warsaw.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans podcast.
Welcome back to the Europeans, the podcast about a continent where it is currently really, really cold. So we'll do our best to warm you up. This is Katie in Paris, and over there in Amsterdam, it is my good friend Dominic Kramer. Hoi.
Hi, hoi. It's been so cold here. I feel like I haven't been able to warm up for days.
I've got a big furry sock that I've been putting in my microwave. That's really weird. It's not really a sock, but recommend sort of furry beanbag thing. I'm just wearing it around the house. It's a bit like having a cat on my feet.
Oh, I've also got some microwavable beanbags, which are the only thing that warm up my feet at night. Mm. But anyway, I feel bad complaining about it considering how cold it is in some other parts of the continent. We heard via our Estonian colleagues at Euronet Plus, this radio consortium we're part of, that a bit of the Baltic Sea between two islands has frozen over and is now being used as a road.
That is wild. The sea has literally frozen over.
Yeah, and it's not just a short stretch. It's 20 kilometers.
Wow.
And apparently, like, people just started spontaneously driving across it, partly because it was hard for the ferries to get through because it was so frozen.
Mm.
And the authorities have decided to open up the ice road, like, officially, because it was happening anyway. And one of the most terrifying facts I heard about this is that people have to keep their seatbelts whilst driving across, just in case they have to make an emergency exit.
Oh, God. That does not sound like a relaxing drive at all.
Right. Anyway, how are you, Katie?
I'm good, yeah. It's not that cold here in Paris, but it's still pretty cold. So I have been staying inside watching the Winter Olympics. Have you been watching?
No, I actually haven't at all, apart from the opening ceremony.
It's been so good this year. And this is probably going to get me cancelled, but I'm going to admit this publicly. Why not? I am not always a totally perfect parent when it comes to keeping my two-year-old son away from screens. And can I just say, I think that all concerns about screen time for toddlers should be suspended when it comes to the Winter Olympics, because we're just having a really good time watching it together. And like, it would be really, really hard for me to explain to him that all of these crazy winter sports exist without showing him a screen.
Okay. Well, I look forward to social services ringing on your doorbell by the end of this recording.
We've only been watching a little bit, but we've been having a great time. Sorry, everyone. Yeah, my son is super into women's big air.
What is that?
There's this like crazily huge ski jump, and then you have to like whiz off it and do a bunch of somersaults.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have to land perfectly on your skis or your snowboard. It is so wild. Like, I cannot believe that this exists as a sport. But yeah, I am also going to justify showing him this on feminist grounds, because he's been watching like women athletes doing rad things on snowboards.
Sure. Okay. Justify it however you want to, Katie.
I will. Oh, man. I love the Winter Olympics. I'm so sad that it's nearly over already. On which note, we'll be talking a little bit about a rather awkward element of the Italian TV coverage of the games in Good Week, Bad Week, I think.
Yes, that's coming up in a bit, along with a look at the rise of social media bans for kids and teenagers across Europe. And after that, we'll be calling up our favourite European train splainer, John Worth, to chat about the state of Europe's railways and why it is that he's decided to set up a European Union for Rail Passengers. So let's get on with the show, shall we?
Let's.
Okay, let's start with Good Week. Who has had a good week, Katie?
Well, this is the segment of this week's show that is brought to you in collaboration with our friends at European radio stations via Euronet Plus. And I am going to give my good week to Portugal, which on Friday became the latest European country to start putting plans in motion for nationwide restrictions on social media use for kids and young teenagers.
Why are you going to Portugal and not the UK? They did too, didn't they?
I'm getting to that. As I was about to say, Dominic, this is really becoming something of a movement across Europe. Back in November, the European Parliament voted by a pretty hefty majority to support a ban on social media use for under 16s, with 13 to 15 year olds only allowed to use these platforms if their parents are okay with it. That vote in the European Parliament was not binding. It doesn't create a Europe-wide social media ban for kids or anything, but it does really reflect how governments across Europe are thinking about this. Denmark, France, Italy, Spain, Slovenia, Norway, Great Britain, as you mentioned, Greece, Germany, all of these countries either have legislation going through the parliamentary process right now that would restrict or ban kids from having social media accounts, or they are debating bringing in such legislation. So it's on the horizon. Now, what these bans would look like varies a little bit from place to place. So in Denmark, for example, you won't be able to have a social media account full stop before the age of 15. In Portugal, the law has passed its first vote in the parliament, but it could still be modified. But the plan there is to allow 13 to 15 year olds to have accounts for sites like TikTok and Instagram if their parents are okay with it. But the general principle is the same. You know, like for years and years, we have had experts ringing the alarm bell about what social media is doing to our kids, whether it is studies about their attention span or the links between excessive social media use and anxiety and depression, online bullying, teenagers feeling rubbish about themselves compared to all of the beautiful people on Instagram, teenagers falling down internet rabbit holes where it is cool to hate women. All of these things, we have known about them for years already. And governments are finally saying, okay, let's actually try and use the law to do something about it. Let's see what happens when we legally limit the access that our kids have to these websites.
It's amazing how, like, suddenly there's this momentum and it seems like loads of governments are actually trying to do something about it.
Yeah.
And honestly, I feel a bit relieved about that. But no European country has actually put one of these social media bans into force yet, have they?
No European country. Yeah, that's correct. There have been age restrictions on various bits of the internet for years already, pornography most notably, but also social media websites. Instagram's own policy is that under 13-year-olds anywhere in the world shouldn't be using the website, at least under their own account. But the only country so far to actually implement a legal ban on under 16-year-olds having social media accounts full stop is Australia. And that is still a really new ban. It was only brought in back in December.
So I suppose it's too early to say how well that's working or not?
Yeah, very much so. There have been some journalistic attempts to report on how Australian kids are feeling about the social media ban a couple of months in. The BBC spoke to one 14-year-old who felt really liberated, actually, by not feeling socially compelled to go on Snapchat all the time. But they also spoke to a 13-year-old who was still using social media just as much as before because he just made new accounts with different birthdays to make him look older.
Oh dear, and I guess that's just one of the big problems, right? Like, how are all of these social media bans gonna stop kids from just creating fake accounts that make them look older and carry on as they were before?
Well, this is the thing, right? I mean, have you ever met a 14-year-old? They are so much better at technology than we are. Obviously, some of them, probably quite a lot of them, are going to find ways around whatever barrier is put up to stop them from using these websites. This is a bit of a tangent, but whatever tool is put in place, I really hope it is more challenging to get past than the age verification tool on the Epstein files. Have you had a dig around that website?
No, I haven't actually.
Okay, so it's really baffling. You are supposed to be age 18 or over to have access to the files. But when you go on the website, it just says, are you over 18? Yes or no? And then when you click yes, it says, thank you for verifying your age. Like, what is the point in that? Like, how many millions of people have wasted a click in doing that?
I mean, yeah, you're right. That does sound really pathetic. But there are some more, like, advanced age verification programs, right? There's this one called Yoti that now exists in the UK. And you really have to, like, upload ID in order to be confirmed, I think. Or they do some, like, facial recognition where they AI works out how old you are.
Yeah, yeah, which is a bit jarring. It takes one look at my face and says, yep, definitely aged over 16. There are, as you say, various different tools for doing this. But it's clear that if we're going to do this on a big scale, we need tools that work really well. Because the data that we do have suggests that at present, many, many European kids are using social media underage. A Danish study found last year, for example, that 94% of Danish children have social media accounts before they turn 13. In Australia, the law puts the duty on social media platforms themselves to put in place some kind of age verification mechanism. So they can choose from the various things available, including the one that you mentioned. In Europe, interestingly enough, the European Commission has been working on an EU-wide app to verify people's age for social media. And it is widely thought that this will probably be the thing that we end up using to enforce all of these social media bans across Europe. That EU app is still being tested, so I can't tell you right now how good it's going to be at stopping 12-year-olds from sneaking their way onto TikTok.
You talked a bit already about like why these social media bans are being brought in, and it's the stuff we all know about, like online bullying, worries about kids' concentration, you know, brains turning to mush from looking at their screens too much.
Yeah.
But to what extent are these legal bans being brought in based on scientific evidence, and to what extent is it like based on news headlines and vibes?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's worth mentioning that research around the impact that social media has on our brains and on our mental health, it isn't this kind of monolith where every researcher ever thinks that social media is completely evil and that it's killing us. It is a lot more nuanced a picture than that. There is a lot of research being done about what social media does to our brains and our mental health, about, for example, what it does to the prefrontal cortex of the brain, which has big roles to play in everything from our attention span to how we regulate our emotions. There are a lot of studies showing a strong correlation between anxiety and depression and heavy social media use. But you will also find some scientists complaining that scary headlines sometimes get written based on data that is ultimately a bit shaky. And you'll also find lots of scientists pointing out that we just haven't been studying the effects of social media on our brains and on our mental health long enough to make big sweeping claims about it. Having said that, as I said, there is a lot of research about this link between excessive social media use and depression and anxiety. Generally, it shows a correlation rather than a causal link, right? Like maybe you're scrolling social media for 3 hours because you're depressed rather than it causing you to be depressed. Mm-hmm. But there is also a growing number of studies tentatively suggesting that there could indeed be a causal link. Now, I should stress here that we're talking about people that really use social media a lot, like more than 3 hours a day.
People like you.
People like me. Definitely people like producer Wojciech. But the fact is, a lot of teenagers do use social media for more than 3 hours a day. Across rich countries in the OECD, more than half of teenagers spend more than 4 hours a day scrolling.
Oh my goodness.
And you don't have to be 15 to have experienced the effects of like a seriously long scrolling session firsthand, right? You know, not just the kind of brain rot that you experience, your inability to string sentences together afterwards, but also how it makes you feel about yourself to have spent hours comparing yourself on Instagram to people that seem to have cooler lives than you do. Or, depending on what your particular algorithm serves you up, maybe consuming a whole bunch of depressing content or angry content. Amnesty International actually did an experiment back in October in France. They set up 3 fake accounts pretending to be 13-year-olds. And in less than an hour of scrolling, all 3 of those accounts were shown content about depression. 2 of them were shown videos expressing suicidal thoughts within 45 minutes.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, this is also in large part about what algorithmic social media is showing our kids and just how harmful those algorithms and the design of those algorithms can be.
It's so sad because, like, at its best, social media could be, and probably still is in some small way, could be a place for, like, kids to find like-minded people and especially, like, kids who feel isolated in their community or, I don't know, queer kids who want to find other queer kids.
Absolutely.
It could be this amazing thing that connects us over the internet, but yeah, it doesn't really seem to be that.
As you say, it still is, and some researchers do try and sort of fight this prevailing narrative by trying to point out that there are positive sides to it too. I will also say that I find in some ways the approach to the conversation about social media and kids to be a bit patronizing, because it very clearly has negative effects for all of us, not just under 16-year-olds. So there's something a bit weird about saying, like, we must save the children from social media, and then bringing in a ban for the under 16s and saying to ourselves, right, that's done now. We've saved the children and I can sit back and scroll my algorithm. Especially because, I'm sorry, but I'm not sure if this is true for everyone, but the older people in my life are some of the most phone-addicted people around me. Is that true for you too?
I don't know if I want to publicly shame the older people in my life. But yeah, you might be right. In any case, it sounds like regardless of age, there are a bunch of risks for your brain, even if we don't have enough science on it yet. And it feels extra risky to subject kids to that. So a ban for kids is a good start with not a lot of downsides.
Right, exactly. And if we do know a limited amount about the effects that this does have on developing brains, is it really responsible to launch this experiment by, you know, just letting an entire generation spend maybe a decade consuming unrestricted social media for 4 hours or more a day? I mean, for me, a safer approach seems to limit it, because the worst that can happen if we restrict it is that their childhood and their adolescence looks quite a lot like our one did. I mean, you and me are part of the generation that grew up with the internet, but without social media. Mm-hmm. I spent most of my teenage years on MSN Messenger. Were you one of those kids?
Yeah, I was. But I mean, the big difference was that I could only access MSN Messenger on my desktop computer.
Family computer.
Yeah, and I had to share it with my three siblings. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't spend that much time on it. It wasn't like I had this tiny device in my pocket all the time.
Yeah.
I do genuinely feel really lucky that I didn't grow up with a smartphone.
Oh my God, me too. Because this is the thing, like, I definitely strayed even on the family computer into corners of the internet that I shouldn't have. You know, there is a lot being written these days about how much, for example, girls get served content by the algorithm that is pro-eating disorder. That stuff was already around when I was a teenager and we found it, like, incredibly dark stuff. But Jesus, it must be so much worse being constantly bombarded with that kind of stuff on TikTok via this device in your pocket than it was back then. I don't know. Like, I don't think that it's possible to totally keep kids off social media. Some of them will open fake accounts depending on the country. Some, maybe a lot of 13-year-olds will get their parents' permission to go on these apps because they'll say, oh, you know, I'm going to be socially excluded if I don't do it. So their parents will let them do it. And let's face it, our kids are definitely still going to see stuff that is inappropriate for them because they're better at the internet than we are. But I do think that at least if we bring these bans in, even partial bans, like in Portugal, we're going to force parents to have conversations with their kids about it. It is going to also signal through the law that this is a thing that is potentially dangerous, like a drug, that is addictive, like a drug, and that it needs to be handled with care. And there'll be millions of kids across Europe who now won't have their own tailored algorithms in their pockets that are designed to keep them watching for hours. And in many cases, are serving up depressing and disturbing content. So yeah, I would argue that given that there is still a ton of research to be done about what social media and screen time do to our brains and our mental health, limiting feels like a fairly good risk-averse approach. I also think this kind of legislation is a good opportunity to help our kids get more media literate. According to Eurobarometer, in 2025, 65% of young Europeans identified social media as their main source of information, which of course means that kids have been eating up absolutely huge amounts of unverified, badly sourced information every day. So if you take away platforms like TikTok, might we dare to dream that teenagers might actually start consuming the news?
Wow, wouldn't that be amazing? I mean, yes, maybe, but the thing I keep thinking about is, like, what are we doing about regulating AI for kids? Like, social media has been around for a long time, and I'm really pleased that this legislation is now starting to grow, but it's taken a long time. Meanwhile, AI is, like, exploding. And yeah, I was talking to some parents recently about how much AI is already being used in their kids' schools. And What other vital skills are kids going to not develop because they're depending on chatbots? Yeah, I don't know.
And that is one of the big criticisms of these social media bans. None of the ones currently on the table includes a ban on using AI chatbots. And that is mostly because of the assumption that these things are going to be a big part of education in the years to come. They already are. For educators, you know, figuring out how to incorporate them into class because they are an inevitability in a way that doesn't encourage students to just stop thinking, that is a massive challenge. But when you read all of these headlines about these horrific cases where teenagers have committed suicide, allegedly after being encouraged to do so by chatbots, it does feel like a massive oversight not to include them in these bans. I don't know. I'm really curious to see what comes of these new laws when they come in various countries. And I do think we should be fully prepared for them to come with some negative consequences. As you pointed out yourself, you know, for some teenagers, social media can be an absolute lifeline. Maybe you are a gay teenager in a place that's really not accepting of that. You'll probably still be able to use the internet to find your people, but it's going to be harder. Autistic teenagers often find it easier to form friendships online. Life is going to get more difficult for them too. Not everyone is even convinced that bans are the way to go. The OECD has actually questioned whether they are the most effective way of reducing the harm of social media. They have suggested that it might be better to focus on giving out clear guidance about how to use social media and support for parents in figuring out how to talk to their kids about it.
Sounds very libertarian to me.
Dominic's all for banning things. I don't know. I mean, ultimately, it does feel like we're taking a gamble in bringing in these laws across Europe. But the worst that can happen with this gamble is that teenagers have the same kind of lame Instagram-free adolescence than we did. And we turned out okay, didn't we?
Well, I guess.
So for that reason, I am giving my good week to Portugal, the latest country to get this kind of legislation off the ground just in the past week. But I'm also going to give it to all of the other countries where this is in the works. Who has had a bad week?
It's been a bad week for Rai, the Italian public broadcaster, after their director of the sports department appointed himself as commentator for the television broadcast of the Olympics opening ceremony and made gaffe after gaffe during the broadcast.
Oh no.
It was so bad that the Rai sports department are now taking industrial action in protest.
Oh God, it's just like the cringiness of this just makes me feel quite ill thinking about taking this job on out of choice.
I know,
and
right?
And they're doing a really bad job of it. How bad must it be for people to like go on strike over it? Like imagine if you messed up something so badly on the Europeans that I went on strike.
I think if it ever came to that, I'd probably realise my time at the Europeans is up. Oh. But yeah, sadly, the director of sports at Rai, he's a guy called Paolo Petrecca. He doesn't seem to have come to that conclusion. Well, not yet, anyway. We're speaking on Tuesday. And there still is a chance that he might end up having to leave his post.
So what kind of things did he actually say during his commentary?
Well, I mean, it started going wrong right at the start of the broadcast when he said, "Welcome to the Olympic Stadium," because even that was incorrect.
Oh,
he
yeah?
was, in fact, speaking from Milan's San Siro Stadium, which is home of AC and Inter Milan, whereas the Olympic Stadium is the stadium in Rome.
Oh.
Like, everyone can make a mistake like this when they're nervously broadcasting a live event to millions of people, but this was only the beginning. He clearly was not prepared because he went on to make a long list of gaffes, including he introduced the famous Italian actress Matilda De Angeli as Mariah Carey.
What?
Con Mariah Carey e soprattutto che...
Mariah Carey is a 56-year-old woman. Matilda De Angeli is 30 years old. They look nothing like each other.
Con Matilda De Angelis che come direttrice d'orchestra.
How did that happen?
Yeah, I don't know. Mariah Carey did perform during the ceremony at another moment with a rather cringy performance that seemed to me to be entirely mimed.
Oh, no.
But that's by the by. There was one awkward moment in which he said that the president of Italy was on screen with his daughter. It was not his daughter. It was Kirsty Coventry, president of the International Olympic Committee. He also used a number of really tasteless nationalistic cliches whilst commentating. He said that, quote unquote, naturally, many of the Chinese athletes have phones in their hands.
Oh, come on.
And he said that Spaniards are always caliente, so like hot, fiery. Generally, it's been received as a mess and an embarrassment to Rye. He also managed conspicuously not to say anything about one person who performed during the ceremony, the Italian rapper Gali, an artist who came under a lot of pressure in the build-up to the ceremony from right-wing figures due to his criticism of Israel.
Okay, this whole thing sounds like a complete mess. It does also sound like my nightmare, presenting live on TV and being completely unprepared, not knowing who anyone is. What kind of industrial action are his underlings, could we call them, his team, what kind of industrial action are they actually launching?
Rye journalists did a one-day byline strike, so they withheld their names from their articles on Monday this week. And they've also announced that they'll go on strike for 3 days once the Olympic Games is over. Unless Petrecha steps down, of course.
And sorry, did you say he appointed himself to do this job of doing the commentary for the opening ceremony?
Yes, someone else was meant to be doing the job, a journalist called Auro Bulbarelli, but he had accidentally revealed one of the big secrets of the ceremony in the run-up to the ceremony about how the president was going to arrive on a tram, and he then had to withdraw. So then Petrecha was like, oh wait, guys, I can do it.
How hard can it be?
And he appointed himself as replacement presenter.
God.
According to reports in La Repubblica, this went against the advice of some of Rai's executives.
Can you imagine those conversations with people saying, no, seriously, Paolo, like, this is a really hard job. You can't just turn up and wing it.
Yeah.
Will, this is maybe an unnecessary question, but will this same guy be presenting the closing ceremony?
No, definitely not. Rai have pulled Petrecha from any more Olympic hosting duties.
Very wise.
No, thank you, Paolo. We won't be needing you for this one. Go and do something else. And look, I don't want to just humiliate him for messing up. Like, commentating on something like an Olympic opening ceremony in your home country whilst it's hosting the Games on the national broadcaster, it's a big job and not an easy job. But then don't just assume you can do it, especially without loads of experience and a huge amount of preparation. And the thing is, this is not Petrecha's first scandal at Rai. Before his job running Rai Sports, he ran Rai News. And yeah, apologies if I start sounding like I'm leaning into cheap national cliches. But the Italian national broadcaster does have a long history of politicized appointments. Petrecha was reportedly chosen by Giorgia Meloni for that job at Rai News before she became prime minister, actually, but while she was in opposition. And he eventually had to leave that job after a vote of no confidence by Rai News journalists. He was accused of giving preferential coverage to Meloni and her government. And he also came under criticism for the harsh treatment of working mothers at Rai News.
Oh, great. I can see why he's made quite a few enemies within his team there.
Yes, exactly. And he's certainly no stranger to employees expressing their discontent with his performance. And yeah, this is not even actually his first major conflict at Rai Sports, where he hasn't even been in post for a full year yet. His editorial plan for Rai Sports has already been rejected twice by the editorial committee of Rai Sports. So yeah, we don't know exactly where this specific Olympic mess up is going to take Rai Sports, but it is just yet another chapter in the long running battle for control of Rai assets and channels from Italian politicians. And we should remember, this is a public service broadcaster. It's paid for by normal Italian citizens, many of whom, I would argue, deserve better than clearly substandard presenting of what could be a moment when people feel very proud to be Italian. Remember that London Olympics opening ceremony, Katie, when we were both living in London back in 2012?
Oh, it's still a really interesting example of like a national event that brings together people across the political divide. Like, everybody found something to be proud of in that ceremony.
Absolutely. I'd never felt more proud of being a Londoner or being British, frankly, than during that London opening ceremony. I know there is an argument made by some that it made people feel so proud to be British that it gave people the confidence to step towards a Brexit vote. but like, that dark thought aside, I wish that the people of Milan and of Italy, the host country of this current Winter Olympics, could have enjoyed the opening ceremony without a presenter like botching everything.
And we should say that for the rest of us watching around the world without Italian commentary, this is a pretty great show. And the games themselves have been so much fun.
It's true. You're absolutely right. So yeah, let's hope that the closing ceremony gets some better commentary for the Italians, because Italy has a lot to celebrate with these games. They are smashing it in terms of medals. They've beaten previous record hauls massively. They're having by far their best Winter Olympics ever.
Yay.
And I'm happy for them. But before I move on from this, I have one or maybe two quick extra points I want to make. Firstly, I do just wish Italian politicians could find a way to resist the impulse to control their public broadcaster and like stop replacing executives and editors as soon as they come into power with political allies. Mm. Since becoming prime minister in 2022, Giorgia Meloni has been harshly criticized for trying to use Rai for her own political goals. There was this extraordinary moment when one of the unions of journalists organized for a statement to be read out on Rai's three main channels in 2022. Condemning Meloni's government for, quote, turning Rai into a government megaphone. It's perhaps no surprise that opposition politicians now refer to Rai as Tele Meloni. It's really a bad situation for democracy in Italy.
Although, isn't it also the case that she is by no means the first Italian politician to try to exert control over this public broadcaster?
Absolutely, you're right. And maybe the difference is simply that Meloni is more right-wing, arguably, than any other post-war prime minister, having emerged out of the post-fascist Italian political movement. So yeah, I think that just makes it a bit more scary. It's worth noting that following Petrecca's opening ceremony embarrassment, he's also come under scrutiny in the Italian press for ballooning spending at Rai Sport under his leadership. So yeah, there are some big question marks around whether he is fit for this job. Mm. All that said, I did feel a small tinge of hope, almost a silver lining, when I watched a video on La Sette Attualità. They interviewed another former director of Rai News who said that this saga had shone a light on something that is very important, that public service broadcasting is about competence and it can't be about favours, propaganda or friendships.
Hey, hey.
So yeah, it was a bad week for Rai, maybe a historically low moment, if you agree with a statement put out by one of the unions for journalists at Rai. But maybe because it happened on the screens of so many millions of Italians, it's made it that little bit harder for politicians to continue getting away with appointing friends at the national broadcaster who are not up for the job. Maybe?
Maybe. Sorry, are we going to talk about the Winter Olympics and not talk about Penisgate?
I'm trying to be a serious podcaster, Katie. But yeah, okay, if you insist, very briefly, there is this parallel scandal at Rai about the fact that in their Olympics opening credit sequence, viewers see an altered version of Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, but with his genitals missing.
He looks like a Ken doll. It's all flat and weird.
He does. You're absolutely right. I should have made this the main crux of my bad week. Mea culpa. And it's actually the second penis gate of the Olympics after there were concerns that ski jumpers might be injecting acid into their penises in order to fly higher.
Oh my God. Why don't we talk about that for the entire episode?
I don't know. I'm sorry. But yeah, there you go. There's your brief Olympic penis update for the week.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's that time in the show when we interrupt proceedings briefly to ask a favour of you. Namely, would you consider supporting us with a small monthly donation on Patreon? The Europeans has been in existence for over 8 years now, and we love making this show each week, but we also think the existence of this show is important, that it has a democratic function in raising awareness of things that are happening across the continent. And we try to do that in a way that is hopefully accessible and sometimes even entertaining or emotional. Like what we're doing here is probably different from what you hear from your public broadcaster or from what you read in your national newspapers.
I really hope it's different from the Italian opening ceremony commentary, at least.
I really hope so too.
In terms of being factually accurate.
That and with more very important penis-related news. Yes. Maybe this is not helping our case, Katie, but yeah, the point is we need your help if we're going to continue doing this. And fortunately, a lot of listeners are already helping us out, and that's the only reason why we are still making this show.
Absolutely. So if you have got a few spare coins a month, even really little amounts can really help us to make this show fundamentally more sustainable and more able to survive into the years to come. This week, we have several new supporters to thank, and they are Anne, Kim, Paul, Pietro, Carla, Meng, and Tom. We would love it if you would consider signing up to join them at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. We are big train fans on this podcast. And it's funny, I feel like I've lived quite a charmed life when it comes to trains. I've had very few train disasters where I've like sat on an unmoving train for 6 hours. So it's kind of obvious for me to like trains because I've had great experiences. Arguably, Dominic, you are a more loyal train fan than me because you love trains, even though you seem to have a train disaster every time you take one.
It's true. I think it's partly because I've taken quite a lot of night trains in the last few years, and they just seem to always go wrong. Like they get cancelled at the last minute or sometimes halfway through the journey in the middle of the night.
Oh, God.
I've gone through Europe in the middle of the night in a train carriage with no heating. Yeah, I've had some bad experiences, and yet I still love traveling by train across this continent of Europe. It's really one of the most magical things about living here, I think, that there is this network and that you can sometimes get from one place to another overnight or during the day, looking out the window at the wonderful countryside.
Yeah, exactly. So whenever it is feasible to take the train, we do. Having said that, as you've already flagged, there are still in 2026 a lot of things that really test our loyalty to trains, not just the breakdowns and the delays, but also, you know, the fact that the plane is often way cheaper, even though it's way more polluting. And there's the fact that booking an international train journey in Europe can be this mammoth administrative task that requires you to be fluent in the use of train booking services in about 4 countries. We deserve better than this, Dominic. One man who believes even more fervently that Europe deserves better trains than we do is this week's guest, John Wirth, the undisputed superstar of European railway campaigning, a British-German dual national like yourself, Dominic, and just someone who is incredibly well-informed about how trains work and about how rail policy works. He mostly writes about rail policy in Europe for a living, but he also campaigns tirelessly online for a better deal for us European train users. And his latest initiative, launched unofficially in December with some other rail activists, is this idea for a European Rail Passengers Union. Why do we need a union? And why are there still so many things wrong with the way that trains work in Europe, even though we love them? We gave John a call at his home in rural France to ask these questions and many, many other nerdy train questions besides.
Hello, John. Thank you so much for joining us on the Europeans.
You're very welcome.
So you've built quite a reputation as one of Europe's most dedicated rail watchers. Where did that fascination with trains come from?
I've always tried to travel by train for environmental reasons. I was working Europe-wide and I started to grow a bit frustrated that it was impossible for me to travel to meet my clients without flying. And after that came a sort of frustration, and that's turned itself into advocacy about railways. I'm really a kind of an outsider to the railway business. I'm a European Union political communications person by background. But in the end, needs must. And if other people are not trying to fix these problems, well, I had a go and I'm still trying.
So just to be clear, do you actually like the experience of taking trains, or is it still just a super practical thing for you?
Yeah, I do, of course. I've travelled on my fair share of interesting train journeys in Europe and beyond. It's not just practicalities. But what I'm trying to demonstrate is actually that the practicalities could really be improved. People often say to me, hey, John, you're a radical. No one else would take a train from Berlin to Lisbon. And I know most people won't take a train from Berlin to Lisbon, but people ought to be able to take a train from Berlin to Paris or Berlin to Vienna or something like that. And I'm aiming to make those kind of shorter journeys more manageable for people. That's the kind of the politics of it. Yeah, but whereas I'm quite happy sat by the window watching the world go by.
But one of the more practical things that you're doing to try and make these journeys easier is that you are one of the people behind a new initiative, the European Rail Passengers Union. Why does Europe need a rail passengers union?
So the difficulty is there are many national organisations that deal with railway issues, but predominantly lobbying national governments. So there is ProBahn in Germany, there's Rover in Netherlands, there's Fnort in France. But the difficulty is passengers are not really heard in the corridors of power of the European Union, and that's what we're trying to put right. We want to basically say there are particular cross-border problems that we wish to seek to solve, notably starting with how difficult it is to even find when certain trains run cross-border and to buy tickets for those trains, and the difficulty that actually if something breaks down, you can be left stranded when you're on a cross-border journey. Now, there's no organisation that's really putting the case for that from a kind of a cross-border railway passengers point of view, and that's why we're trying to start a little association in order to manage to make that happen. And in European Union business, you get what you lobby for, and the railway companies, they are heavily represented in the corridors of power, and they're not very keen on making that much easier for passengers to take cross-border trips.
So it's mainly about lobbying is what I hear, but you're also going to be helping people out with like individual horror stories that they might have experienced while crossing borders on trains.
Well, we'll do our best with that. I'm not sure we've necessarily got the resources to help out with every cross-border nightmare. But the ultimate issue's got to be is when you're stuck, who's going to be able to step in and help you and to manage to make sure that you reduce the numbers of those kinds of problems. And so therefore, if we get the legal framework right, the numbers of individual horror stories that we should hear from all of this ought to ideally be reduced.
And what are these horror stories that you hear? If you had to pick two or three of your sort of most infamous battles that you've heard about, what are they?
So, there's an awful one. A friend of mine, he was trying to go from Germany to Spain with his family. Train breaks down, getting to Paris. He's there with his family in Paris. The night train to the south of France has long departed. He's like, what are we going to do now? And oh dear, the train is not going to go tomorrow either. And he ends up getting stranded there. Now, in the end, he found a way and means of managing to get his hotel accommodation paid for by the railway companies. Now, bear in mind, it's not only just the passengers that have some of these absurdities when it comes to cross-border travel. Even the railway companies, there's a long-going dispute at the France-Spain border where the train drivers of the Spanish trains are not even allowed to use the restroom of the French train drivers in the station on the French side of the border. And you're like, come on.
It's outrageous.
Put your stupidities aside, right? I kind of like it that my Spanish train driver could have a reasonable rest before he or she carries on their shift. So ultimately, all over the place, be it either at the individual level or at the kind of more strategic level, there are all kinds of headaches that either make you frustrated to say, why the hell do these problems exist in the first place? But you can also see the flip side to that. Some of these ought to be actually quite easy to fix.
Yeah, well, it definitely sounds like there's a lot of room for improvement and quite a lot of low-hanging fruit. But one of the things you mentioned earlier was how difficult it can be to book a cross-border journey and that sometimes you have to buy tickets from different companies for the same journey. It's incredibly fiddly and confusing. Now, I know the European Commission has got some plans bubbling away to try and make this easier. Are you optimistic that things will actually improve here anytime soon?
I'm really optimistic that the European Commission is going to bring forward a good draft regulation, which is going to be coming out this spring. It's due. The European Commission has understood these problems and is serious about wanting to solve them. The problem, however, is once this draft is out, it then needs to be decided by the other European Union institutions, the European Parliament, which doesn't give me any reason for concern. But most importantly, when this lands with the member states of the European Union in the Council, they are all going to be strongly pressured by their national railway companies that don't really care about international journeys, and the danger then comes that the legislation will be watered down at the end of the process.
I mean, as far as I understand, on paper, the EU already has fairly strong rail passenger rights, right? No, you're supposed to get a partial refund if your train was more than an hour late, for example. What is the reality here?
The difficulty in railways is it's very seldom, if you're traveling internationally, that one company can do your entire journey. And so you have to have different companies, one after the other, in the journey chain. And they've never found a way and means of compensating each other. So if I'm starting in Germany, my train gets delayed, I then miss my connection in France, which means I get stranded there and I can't actually carry on my journey to get all the way to Barcelona, for example, who pays? Is it the German company that caused the delay in the first place? place? Is it France, where I ended up getting stranded? Well, it definitely shouldn't be the Spanish, who probably were the kind of last ones down that chain. But basically, you can end up being left with a hefty bill as a traveller. Now, that's exactly what the European Commission is then wanting to fix.
Yeah, I've had some pretty horrifying stories where I've had to write letters back and forth from Deutsche Bahn, like by post as well. And then they say, no, actually, it's not us that needs to deal with this. And it all takes months and months. And yeah, you give up at a certain point.
Well, and also, ultimately, it's really important that in the end, if your journey by train, it takes longer than flying, probably costs you more than it does flying, right? You've got to have an intrinsic motivation to want to do this. And then still you get stuck and you end up having to foot the bill. Like, that's just one layer too much for most passengers, right? So I can totally understand that frustration.
Are there other, while we're talking about planes, are there other regulations and taxes in place on a European-wide level that give the aviation industry an unfair advantage over the train industry?
There are, but I'm personally in my work a little bit reluctant to use that argument. My effort is to say, how does the railway industry improve itself on its own feet? Many railway industry people say, well, everything would be fine for us if only a planes had to pay tax on kerosene, or I don't know, Flixbuses had to pay a toll to use the German autobahns. It's true, but if you just see that someone else has a comparative advantage, that means, in my view, you don't put your own problems right. So you're ethically right, but I'm not trying to advance that one, at least in my everyday work.
You've talked about how much you really have to have like a personal drive to take a train at the moment sometimes over other forms of transport. Just to give you an example, our producer Wojciech, he was recently booking tickets to come to Paris, and he ended up buying a plane ticket, which he really didn't want to do. And he did that because currently it takes a full day to get from Warsaw to Paris by train. You can actually drive it considerably faster in about 18 hours. Hypothetically speaking, what would it need to take for Wojciech to be able to look at all of these different options and say, you know what, the train really does make the most sense for me in practical terms. It's the best option.
So what's Warsaw to Paris as the crow flies? Something like 1,700 kilometers, something like that, right? Give or take.
1,600, just looked it up. Very good.
My father, who's a geography teacher, would have been happy with that one. ultimately, for a daytime train on existing infrastructure, that's too far. Realistically, however fast that train would go, and unfortunately between Berlin and Warsaw, it's quite slow, the line speed, you're going to have a hell of a long trip, however you look at it. And there is no way of doing that overnight instead. Now, that would be the viable option, but there used to be, for example, a Warsaw to Brussels night train that used to run up until the early 2010s. So if you hop on a night train and then take a Eurostar from Brussels to Paris in 1 hour and 20, then that would be a viable connection. So first of all, an absence of night trains makes those really long journeys Europe-wide very, very difficult. Second, even if you were to attempt it in the day, it's quite difficult because, for example, there is only one direct train a day from Berlin to Paris, and it goes at 7 in the morning, which doesn't allow you enough time to get an early morning departure from Warsaw in order to even get yourself to Berlin. So we need, for some of those connections, particularly international ones, more services. And then in the third thing we need to look at is whether you actually need to up the line speed to allow high-speed trains to make those connections. Now, Poland has this CPK project for building high-speed lines across Poland. So by the early to mid-2030s, Warsaw to Berlin should be a good bit faster. So that is what I would say would be the recipe. Night trains in the short term. Second, we need better timetables cross-border of our daytime trains. And third, in the medium term, where in Europe do we need more high-speed lines? And that should ultimately give the kind of combination that we need.
I do keep hearing about more and more night train lines opening up across Europe. I mean, how is this supposed night train renaissance going at the moment?
It's not really going anywhere, which is rather disappointing, although it must be said for somewhat understandable reasons. The ultimate central problem is there simply aren't enough night train carriages to go around. All the night trains that run are largely using very old carriages, some of them almost literally saved from the scrap heap to keep them running. And no European night train operators, other than the Austrians, which are the big exception, have even bought any new night train carriages in the last 2 decades. So if you want to step up night trains, you need someone to buy and build some new carriages. Who's going to do that? Well, the state-owned railway companies are not keen on night trains because you don't make much money, if any money at all, out of running them. So the companies that could do it, Deutsche Bahn, SNCF, have very little will to do so, and the smaller countries and some small private operators don't have the financial means. So this private night train operator that's been running Brussels, Amsterdam, Berlin, Prague, called European Sleeper, they want to run more night trains, but they don't have the finances to buy any new carriages, which make that train not a pleasant user experience. You're kind of stuck between this customer demand on one hand and the companies not being able to deliver on the other.
We need some like billionaire philanthropist trainer to just buy a ton of night carriages.
It would be nice, but I've not got the name of one for you, unfortunately, on the tip of my tongue.
This has been an amazing chat for train enthusiasts like Dominic and me. I've learned so much. Before we let you go, John, we thought it'd be nice if you left us with a little bit of railway inspiration. What is your all-time favorite train journey to take in Europe?
Ooh, this is a really interesting one. So I'm going to go for an exotic one. The railway that goes from Belgrade in Serbia to Bar in Montenegro via Podgorica, the capital of Montenegro. Mm-hmm. It has the second highest railway bridge in the entire world. It was long time actually the highest railway bridge until the Chinese opened a higher one a couple of years ago. It's an amazing historical connection. It goes over high bridges, has amazing scenery, and it was very important for the kind of attempted unification of Yugoslavia, despite the dissolution of Yugoslavia into its separate component parts. The train still runs, and indeed it's a kind of a hidden gem. It's an amazing, amazing trip on some slightly old, slightly rickety trains. It doesn't go very fast, but to take a night train on that route, wake up in the morning and you have the mountains of Montenegro out of the window, that in Europe anyway is an absolutely amazing and brilliant trip that I can really highly recommend.
Going straight on my bucket list. Thank you so much, John.
No problem. Thank you.
Loyal as I am to Europe's night trains, I do think we have a lot to learn from Asian night trains. Mm. I don't know if you've ever taken an Asian night train, but I feel like in Malaysia and Thailand, there's a little pocket for everything and your little bunk, which is really fun and convenient. Chinese night trains, there is a hot water tap in the corridor for your noodles. Hey. We don't have either of these things in Europe. Well, in France, at least.
Well, actually, there are some new night trains on the Austrian train provider that where you have like a little pod to sleep in yourself. I haven't been in it yet.
Does it have pockets?
I think it does have pockets, yeah.
Oh, well, there you go.
And a sliding door.
And I'm just hearing producer Katz in my ear telling me that in Ukrainian night trains, there are pockets galore. So I'm going to have to test that out too. Are you someone who uses trains a lot for work or for pleasure? The European Rail Passengers Union is just getting off the ground, and John and the other activists behind it would love your help in getting stuff organized. So we'll drop a link in the show notes where you can find out more. You can also just sign up to get updates if you're curious about it, but not up for volunteering your time. John has also launched a newsletter recently, which is going to be an absolute must read for the diehards interested in all things European rail. So you will find a link to that too. How appropriate. Our train is now pulling into the inspiration station right on time. What have you been enjoying this week, Dominic?
Now, you're into video recipes, aren't you, Katie? Like food TikTok. I think you once made me a delicious gnocchi from a TikTok recipe.
Viral TikTok recipes, yes. Much less so. I actually haven't logged into TikTok in about 4 or 5 months now. Don't know what's happened. I've just gone off it.
Well done you. Who needs a social media ban?
But I am still consuming quite a lot of like YouTube recipes, it's true.
Okay, well that's good because I have a YouTube recipe to recommend today from everyone's favorite Catalonian pop superstar, Rosalía.
She does recipes now?
Well, she put out a recipe with Vogue last week in which she cooks tortilla de patatas, also known as a Spanish omelette. And I'm now even more obsessed with Rosalía after spending 14 minutes watching her cook her omelette in between sips of a glass of Sancerre.
What lovely.
She is marvelously chaotic in the kitchen, but manages to still look fabulous in her black corset whilst flipping the omelette rather precariously back and forth. I haven't actually tried the recipe yet, but I am planning on giving it a go. And if any of you do try it before I do, then let me know how it turns out. Maybe we can exchange notes. I'm a little bit skeptical that it's going to work because the omelette that she ends up with doesn't look the best. And she does use almost like an entire bottle of olive oil whilst cooking it. But even if you're not going to make it, it's a really fun watch.
Ah, can't wait to watch this.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
Staying in roughly the same part of the world, I am halfway through the Spanish TV series Los Años Nuevos, which translates as The New Years in English. Have you watched it yet?
No, I haven't heard of it, actually.
So it's been doing the rounds as the kind of TV show that will fill the hole in your life left by normal people, if you watched / read that a few years ago. It is a relationship drama. It's about a couple living in Madrid, Anna and Oscar. And the thing that makes the show so striking is that it's set on the same day of the year, every day for 10 years, New Year's Eve. So we get to see them do that Spanish thing of trying to eat 12 grapes really quickly at midnight, which is fun.
But this makes it sound like one day.
Very similar to one day as well. Very much in the same kind of like big, intense relationship drama genre. And because it's set on the same day every year, we get to see these snapshots each year of how this couple are doing and the ups and downs of their relationship. As I say, it makes it quite an intense watch because it really does feel like you're living this relationship with Anna and Oscar. And it lasts the whole of their 30s, this formative decade where, yeah, life changes for a lot of us when it comes to how we think about work, maybe starting a family, and the kind of lives that we want to have, like what we think is important. I will say it's quite a steamy TV show. There are some quite racy scenes, if that's your jam. Mm-hmm. Some of them quite long. but the sex feels quite realist. And it's generally quite a realist depiction of two people being attracted to each other, but also finding each other frustrating in all kinds of ways. It's quite heartbreaking at points. Sometimes it's funny. It also moves around Europe a bit. It's mostly set in Madrid, but we also go to Berlin and Lyon. I am loving this show. It's available in lots of places, depending on where you live. If you live in a country that has Arte and you can read French or German subtitles, you can watch it there. It is also on Mubi in a lot of places, apparently. But yeah, massive recommend from me, Los Años Nuevos.
And sorry, is it a film or a TV show?
TV show. 10 episodes, 10 years.
I sometimes find Spanish TV that I've watched to be like a little bit too glossy for my taste. Is this also in that category?
Absolutely not. This is like incredibly unglossy. Elements of it are really unglamorous. You know, you hear this couple talking about like cutting your nails on the sofa, like all of these like little relationship things that happen in real life. So very much not in that genre. And I would say, well worth your time.
Okay, I'm convinced. For this week's happy ending, we're heading to Derbyshire in the East Midlands in England, where a man suspected of stealing tobacco was on the run from the police.
Oh, no.
He jumped over a fence into a field and ran as fast as he could, but little did he know in that field, there was a group of conscientious citizens who realised something was amiss and they managed to surround him in a ring.
Okay.
Now, when I say conscientious citizens, I actually mean a herd of llamas. And apparently, one of the llamas first spotted the man and let out like an alarm cry, which brought the others into action and they surrounded him, meaning he couldn't get away. Now, my favourite thing about this story, which I found out about via some reporting from ITV News, is that apparently the llamas not only surrounded him, but they all started doing this warning cry,
wow,
which, according to the landowner, a woman called Heidi Price, sounds like old men laughing. I've got a clip here of some llamas doing the noise that maybe you want to listen to. It's really a great sound, isn't it?
I love it.
So, yeah, not only was this man trapped by the llamas, but they were laughing at him. The man was subsequently arrested and has been released on bail. Who needs the police when you have llamas to sound the alarm?
Oh, this is why we pay you the big bucks. They should hire you at Rye.
They should. I'm ready for the closing ceremony.
One of the things we want to do a bit more of this year is bring you a few more episodes that are made up of just one big, expansive conversation. So we are bringing you one of those next week. We had such a good conversation last week with this interviewee that we thought, you know what? We're just going to give you the whole conversation. It is a conversation with Emma Holton, author of Deficit, a book about why our economy and the study of economics are so skewed against women. She gave me so much to think about. I really can't wait for everyone to hear what she has to say.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it too. This week's episode was produced by Kat Laszlo and Wojciech Oleksiak. Thank you, both of you. And thank you to our jingle makers, Jim Barn and Mariska Martina. You can find us on YouTube, Instagram, Blue Sky, Mastodon, and you can find our newsletter on Substack, Good Week, Bad Week. People are really enjoying it. Me too, actually. I'm really proud of Morgan.
It's so great. Go subscribe and use that as a way of staying off social media, people.
Isn't Substack also social media?
Oh, God. Okay. If you are under a self-imposed social media ban, please don't let that include any of our content. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Hasta la próxima.